Let's get kinky. You're listening to the Funny Dom Podcast.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to the show. This week, we're going to tackle a bunch of your questions from yesterday's Q&A. And I'm going to make a bit of a exciting announcement. So that'll be fun. I was going to keep it under wraps, but I'm too excited about it. And just like my gift-giving love language, I'm bad at keeping secrets when it comes to things like this. When I buy a gift, I have to at least say, oh, I've got you a gift. And if I manage to not take a photo of it or make a hint about what it is, then I'm doing very well. But this is something special, and it's a bit of a daydream up until fairly recently, so it'll be fun to share that. But right now, let's get to your questions.
Through your content, I learned that there's a difference between topping and dominating, and that was very helpful and eye-opening because it gave words to a feeling I've been having for a long time, especially when dating, because there seems to be a lot of men out there that like slapping the bum during sex or being a little bit more rough, and a lot of them call themselves dominant. But when they are talking about what they like, it never felt like dominance to me the way I like to experience it. So just learning that there's a difference was already very helpful, but I'm noticing I still have problems and I can't fully grasp it to put into words when trying to explain the difference to somebody else. So to me, it's just a feeling more so. Would Sir be so kind to define the differences again and make it more tangible, please?
I think a lot of people get confused between the differences between the position and the actions of topping and bottoming and the identity and the presence of a dominant or a submissive. They are very different things. A simple way to picture it or to feel a more tangible sense of what the difference is that topping is an action. So men or just people who incorrectly understand it, that it's an action, so they must be dominant because they like, or even just believe they like to deliver, you know, strikes or spanking or be in a kind of top position just sexually. I think that's an identity. It's a role. So the difference is that topping is an action or a practice. It's a doing. But dominant is a self. It's a presence. So to be dominant requires not an action. It requires only presence. And that is why you'd be able to feel the difference with those partners or those people that you've connected with, because they are communicating that they enjoy or believe an action is theirs, something they can do, and that makes them something, which is incorrect. And also you're not sensing the presence of their actual identity, which is vital. And is the entire thing. That's all there is. So even a dominant who may not like spanking or conventional practices that you might expect, the identity is still there. So you're going to sense that. And especially if they're aware of it and they're leaning into it and they're comfortable in their identity, it's going to be felt in the way they hold space. So that really is what the identity is. The dominant identity is, I often describe it as a room. The dominant is a walking space. They're an identity that has a floor and walls and a ceiling for a submissive to be in. And they have that as part of their presence. Wherever they go, whatever they're doing, it's there. And the room might be in different states depending on where they're at and how they are, but it is there. It is part of what they are, and that is the difference. A top does not have that room. It's not part of their identity. They may be able to do practices and enjoy practices that overlap with what a dominant may and a submissive needs or enjoys, but the fundamental need is space, is safety in space in that room. So I hope that helps.
Good morning. I want to ask, when you're vetting a new sub, what are some important questions that you ask or some significant traits that you look for? Thank you.
That's a great question. We often so much focus on vetting dominance from a submissive point of view. I have had a few DOMs reach out and ask me about my vetting guide and vetting practices and how they can do their own vetting well. And I tell them that the basics are very similar. You can use the vetting guide that's on my Patreon, whether you're a sub-DOM, switch looking for a switch, pet looking for an owner. It's not identity attached necessarily. The kind of fundamentals are all the same. The things you're looking for, compatibility and safety, you need just as much as anyone, DOMs out there. And for me, very much I've it's taken kind of trial and error and experience to hone that I'm not just looking for compatible preferences. I think people get stuck on that. Oh, I like wax play, so they like wax play, so we're going to be good together. And it's like, no, that's great that you might like the same flavors. You might like, you know, pasta and they like pasta. That's great, but that is not a relationship. The really important things are a sense of safety and stable ground, I call it. I need to get a sense of the person being stable ground for me to be on as a partner. And that's the kind of biggest thing I've found. If I get a sense of that ground being inconsistent or shaky or not reliable, then I don't feel safe as a dominant. I need to feel secure and safe just as a sub does in order to connect and be safe, because being your identity, whatever it is a vulnerable state. So if I'm going to be a dominant attached to a submissive, I need to know that they are in a good place for the dynamic and for me. And if I get a sense that they are not, that alarms me and that makes me feel uncomfortable. So that kind of sense of being in a good place and working towards being in the best place they can be, that's what I kind of like look for. That's what makes me feel safe and happy and excited to connect and go further in a dynamic. So I ask a lot of questions about experience and attitude, and a lot of it is intangibles, getting a sense of their consistency of approach, you know, towards their own lifestyle and attitudes, their ability to regulate and respond instead of react. These are things that we all struggle with to some degree at some point, but I need a good sense of that being in a decent place and being worked on or aware of to get to, you know, hopefully an even better place, as we all are.
To support this space and to get access to TFD's exclusive guides to kink, spicy content and more, check out his Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefunnydom.
Okay, let's have a look at some of your Q&A questions this week. First up, how do you budget your time to stay on top of enforcing rules? How to budget your time? Well, you budget your time by budgeting your time. Everybody struggles with time. I think the trick, it's not a trick. I think the thing is it's planning and preparation and doing your best. You're not going to be perfect, but if you know that you're, you know, time poor and that you need to budget your time, then you need to put in some more effort and some more creative thinking into how to stay on top of enforcing, you know, rules and whatever structure you've put in place. That means being mindful about how you're doing these things. Are you taking notes? Do you have a journal or a place to put down where you're at with certain you know, structures with your partner or partners. I have not only the, you know, any rules or expectations with partners, but I'm working with, you know, many people, and several of them have rules or protocols or expectations, and I take notes and keep track, you know, mindfully of those things. Not 100%. There's still times where, you know, something will slip through or you need to be reminded, but, you know, you do your best, and you should be able to stay on top of these things by just doing that. Stay mindful, take notes, take a very practical, formal approach to it. And people might think that's takes away some of the fun. It's actually leaning into those things makes things more exciting and more trust inviting, I find. Like, you tell your partner that you've bought a specific, you know, journal, you know, or book, you know, somewhere where you're going to keep track of their behavior and how they're doing with whatever it is that, you know, you've arranged in your dynamic. I find partners love that. People I work with love that. When I tell them I've put a little note on a whiteboard on my desk about what they're doing, I get good reactions. So, yes, I would say first step is take notes and keep track and keep it a regular space and time for yourself to consult these notes and work on them, and it becomes a lot easier. Next, we have you any additional podcast books or any other resources for beginner DOMs? Now, I'm going to make a what might be a reactionary assumption here, so cut me some slack for that. I might be incorrect, but I think this is coming from a submissive, and I'm kind of annoyed by this, not at your message, dear person that has sent this question, at the fact that I've had these questions before, and I rarely get the version of this question from the dominant. I feel like I get questions regularly from partners, submissive partners, who are asking on their partner's behalf for resources. Now, on a certain level, that's not only okay, it's great. I think that's a really good, mindful way of being in service as a partner, is to look for resources and things to help your dominant, whether they're new or very experienced. If you find something like, oh, I think that my partner would really like this or get something out of it, then that's fantastic. You're doing a good job. But this, for me, my intuition tells me this is a partner who is a new dominant, and instead of them reaching out and looking for things, they are doing it. And it's the instead that worries me, that kind of annoys me, because I get a sense of, and again, this is an assumption, so I could totally be wrong, but there's definitely instances of this happening. This is definitely happening, where the dominant is kind of lazy or complacent, and they're not actually investing energy themselves. They're just like, oh yeah, I'm that, or I'm gonna, like, you know, get better at that. And then their partner is off looking for things, asking me questions, looking for resources, suggesting books. And that's just not the way. It's already a big mark against this new dom, who should be, this message should be coming from them, you know. And I just don't get enough of those messages. I do sometimes, and I really like to see it. The dom will be like, hey, I'm new, what can I do to get further along in my journey in education? And I'm like, yes, fantastic, good. But I get these ones more, and it just pisses me off a little bit. So I might be wrong, but assuming that that's what this is, if that's what this is your message and your partner, then yeah, there are resources, there are lots of things. The first thing is personal investment. So get them to do this. You shouldn't have to do this, okay? If they are already doing things like this, and this is just you being supportive, then that's brilliant, fantastic. Send him to, like, my page, you know, get him to subscribe and learn from all the guides that are on my page. Get him to buy my book. I mean, obviously, this is all helping me, but they're there for that reason. And I wish there were more DOMs and new DOMs, especially new male DOMs, who were coming forward and wanting to work with me and get like coaching or advice or support or buying the book, you know? So, yeah. If they're not already doing that, I think the thing to consider is not how to help them, it's why aren't they already doing that? Because that's a worry. Next question. This is very sweet. Best way to tell a partner you're a little feeling nervous about messing up, scaring him off. And then the little crying face emoji. I understand that you're nervous about this. Showing your any identity and sharing this with a partner is very vulnerable. And it feels like a big risk or a big gamble. But don't forget that if sharing a big part of yourself scare someone off, they're probably not a good partner for you. Like, this is a very key part of your identity. If you're compatible with this person, they're not going to be scared off. Now, obviously, you could potentially do the sharing in a, you know, confronting way. So try not to do that. You know, try to talk about it. The best way to do that really is to just, it is just to talk about it. It's just to use your words. Just go, hey, I've got something to talk about. There's a part of my identity. Like, use those words. It's not just, hey, this is a thing I like. Because if your partner doesn't have any understanding, they're just going to see it as a thing that you like to do, that it doesn't sound as important to them. If they don't understand it, if they're not into it, they might be dismissive or they might not see it as critical. But if you say this is part of me, they're going to take it more seriously. And again, if they don't, then that's someone who hears that you're sharing part of you and doesn't take it very seriously. That's not someone you actually want to be with. So just ask to talk about something, you know, quite important to you, that's about part of you. You can tell them that you're feeling a little nervous. It's a vulnerable thing you're going to share, to let them, you know, kind of prepare and hear you in that way. And if they are a good potential partner and actually compatible, they will at the very least be very kind and open and try to understand and perhaps learn more about what they don't know, so they can be more aware and understanding. Good luck. And feel free to let me know how it goes. I think a lot of the times these conversations are a lot easier and a lot warmer than people worry they might not be. So I hope it works out well. And if he needs more understanding of littles and littleness, then send him some, you know, memes, send him some, you know, podcasts, find some of the good pages on littleness. You know, that I often share a few of them, and, you know, just show him examples, you know, and explain that it is about safety and care, you know, and healing and all these like play and all these like beautiful positive things, so that he really understands. I hope it goes well. Let me know. Here's an easy one. Should I go no contact with ex-DD? He broke up badly, ruined trust and friendship. No repair efforts made. This is one of those questions where I think the answer is so obvious that it's almost in the question. And you definitely already know it. And you're just looking for a bit of confirmation, which is very fine. Validation and hearing something out loud is often what a lot of us need to take a step. Yes, you do need to go no contact, probably for good. This sounds awful. This partner broke up badly. Bad breakups happen. Ruined trust. That's bad. That can happen too. And friendship. And this is the really big bump. No repair efforts made. So no effort to repair anything, make anything better. I'm assuming bad communication through all this. There's absolutely no reason to stay in contact with this person. Even if those things hadn't been the case, if you're trying to end a connection and move forward, I think some time of no contact is healthy to have space. So at the very least, I think a few weeks or a month is probably best for you anyway. But considering it was a bad breakup, trust was ruined, also friendship ruined, and there's no repair effort being made, then I don't know why you would want to stay in contact with this person. I think it would probably just lead to more hurt. So absolutely, I think go completely no contact. You can communicate that. That is the best way to do it. You don't have to. You're allowed to do what you need to do. But if you want to try and do the ideal version, then let them know that because of these reasons, you're going no contact, and please respect that. And that's it. Don't say anything else. Block numbers if it helps you. It probably will. You don't want kind of passive reminders of that person in your day-to-day. It'll just make it more difficult. So just take space from them and give yourself a month or two to find some rebalance, okay? Grieving takes time, and you have to do it for yourself. I hope that helps. Okay, let's do one more. In my current relationship, I'm the sub and my partner is the dom, but my partner is a switch, but I'm not. And I often worry I'm not enough for them sexually because I can't top. They tell me that it's okay, but I still worry them saying that to make me feel better. Any advice? I think your worry is correct. Like, I would validate your concern. It's great for them to say that it's okay, but I would kind of question whether they're being honest with themselves. They're probably not lying, but the fact is, if they're a switch, they have a balance need. Even if it's not right now, at some point, they have that other space where they do need to switch. And at a certain point, if they're not going to, it's going to build up. And if they deny it, even if they don't resent you for it, they're going to be unbalanced. It's a need that is not being served. And it is not your job or responsibility to serve that because it doesn't align with your own identity. So they're going to have to get that need served in another way. Now, that's not your responsibility either. It's theirs to actually acknowledge that and be aware of that and to do that. But it is going to make you worried because your intuition is, well, hang on, you have both these kind of needs and I fit with one but not the other. And you want them to be happy and be compatible. So I think you need to talk to your partner more and discuss how that's going to work, because I agree with you. I would be worried about that as well. You know, I've been with, you know, switches, and luckily I am, you know, non-monogamous and poly, so it kind of, that, you know, works well. But if I wasn't, then I would be aware that my degree of bottoming, which is very, very narrow, indeed very narrow, then I don't think that's going to be enough for them if that's a strong half of their identity, as it usually is with a switch. So, yes, I think you need more communication, and I think you need to help your partner maybe feel safe and comfortable enough to acknowledge that that is a need that they have, and that it's okay that you are unable to serve that need. That's totally okay, because it's just not part of your identity. I often go to bowling as an example, just because it diffuses tension, because it seems silly to just say, you know, it's like, if they love bowling, they really identify with bowling, it's part of their life, and you do not like bowling at all, it's okay for someone to go and bowl with someone else. So I don't know what your relationship style is, but even if it needs to be more platonic, there are ways for them to switch with boundaries that may work for your relationship. So I think you need to talk about that more and be clearer that you are worried and that there's a very valid reason for you to be concerned, okay? Okay, announcement time. Big announcement time. Here we go. Are you ready? Are you ready for a big announcement? Time for the big announcement. Why do I keep teasing you about a big announcement? Here it is. The big announcement is that I'm planning a trip to the States to do an appearance and a book signing. That's right. Now, if you're not in the United States, that is probably less of a big announcement. It's not very practical for you. But I am not at the state where I can do a world tour just yet. But the book is doing well enough that if it keeps doing this well, and if you all help, then I might be able to actually fly over to San Francisco and maybe even New York to do an appearance for you. Most of the followers on Instagram and on the podcast listening are in the United States. That's the largest audience. So that is the obvious place to go to first. I've also spent a little bit of time on the West Coast, so I'd really like to visit there again. So that is the initial plan. Hopefully, I'll be able to do a Europe trip as well, or in the future as well. Like, that would be amazing. But I'm still accepting that this has come to pass. So the book has sold around 60 or 70 copies. If it gets to 200, and I don't mean tomorrow, I just mean this year. If it gets to 200, I'll be able to come to America and do a book signing. I'll bring copies of this book. I'll bring maybe another something special to sign for people. You can come along and get a copy of the book autographed. Say hello. I'd love to actually meet many of you that are on the West Coast in California. I can come along and actually say hi and meet in person for the first time after all this time being connected and speaking with many of you over chat and on calls and people I've worked with. It could be amazing. So I'm talking to someone pretty amazing in San Francisco right now about using their space for this event. And I'm looking at around September, October, if all this comes together. And it'd be amazing. I did not think that something like this would be possible, but so many of you have been supportive, and so many of you have bought a copy of the book that I'll be able to do this trip just on the sales of my self-published kink guide, which is amazing. And then I'll be able to take it there and autograph copies and meet as many of you as you can practically come along. And I'll give everyone notice so it will be possible. And if you're on the East Coast or it's just easier for you to get there, then I'm going to try and shoot over to New York and maybe do a similar event and appearance somewhere. Find a bookshop and let's fill a cool space with kinksters. It'd be so lovely to have a whole little line of littles and subs and doms and couples and switches lining up to say hello. Be amazing. So that's the big announcement. That's the plan. The smallest and kinkiest book tour in the history of sex positive publishing. That's what it will be. So thank you for even making it possible. And if you've been thinking of getting a copy of the book, then please use this to motivate you to do so. The more copies it sells, the more likely this is to actually happen. And maybe I can do this regularly, shoot over somewhere so that I can meet people and say hello. It'd be beautiful. It's so wholesome. So yes, thank you again to everyone who's already bought a copy. I love seeing the videos people send me of them flicking through their copy of the book. That's amazing. So thank you again. And that's the announcement. Huzzah. And that brings us to our final segment of the show, our ongoing reading after Anna Gabaldon's Outlander. So we'll get back onto that. We left off quite a heated, spicy scenario was occurring on my copy. It's page 57. So let's get back into that now, if you're going to read along or just listen along. Then I hope you're comfortable and cozy, and feel free to drift off if this is your bedtime listening and I've managed to keep you awake so far with my dulcet tones. And feel free to completely zone out and go into dreamland. It's absolutely okay. It might not be possible right away though, because the first line is, he sprang the clasp of my brassiere. So here we go. Here we go. This is Outlander time, folks. He sprang the clasp of my brassiere with one accomplished flick of the thumb and bent to pay a skilled homage to my breasts. A skilled homage? I'm not sure. Sorry, this is not in the book. I'm just taken aback by a skilled homage. No, I don't know if I've paid a skilled homage to a pair of breasts before. I guess if kind of attacking them and I mean, I guess that it depends on what homage you're into. Let's get back into it. Then he drew back and, cupping my breasts with both hands, drew his palms slowly down to meet between the rising mounds, and without stopping, drew them softly outwards again, tracing the line of my ribcage clear to the back. Up and again, down and around, until I moaned and turned towards him. He sank his lips onto mine and pressed me towards him, until our hips fitted tightly together. He bent his head to mine, nibbling softly around the rim of my ear. The hand stroking my back slipped lower and lower, stopping suddenly in surprise. It felt again, then Frank raised his head and looked down at me, grinning. "What's all this, then?" he asked, in imitation of a village bobby. "Or rather, what's not all this?" "Just being prepared," I said primly. "Nurses are taught to anticipate contingencies." "Really, Claire," he murmured, sliding his hand under my skirt and up my thigh to the soft, unprotected warmth between my legs. "You are the most terrifyingly practical person I've ever known." Quick note there. So no underwear she's wearing, or bloomers, or whatever they'd be called in this era, which is typically supposed to be such a hot, sexy thing. But for me, I like the thought or the concept, but if they're not there, I can't rip them off. So I prefer they be there. Anyway. Too much digression so far. Apologies. Frank came up behind me as I sat in the parlour chair that evening, a large book spread out on my lap. "What are you doing?" he asked. His hands rested gently on my shoulders. "Looking for that plant," I answered. "Hang on, we just rushed through. So we got, you are the most terrifyingly practical person I've ever known. And then she's in the parlour chair that evening. I was hoping for at least one more page of debauchery there. Okay, we'll be patient. Frank came up behind me as I sat in the parlour chair that evening, a large book spread out on my lap. "What are you doing?" he asked. His hands rested gently on my shoulders. "Looking for that plant," I answered, sticking a finger between the pages to mind my place. "The one I saw in the stone circle. See?" I flipped the book open. "It could be in the Gentianaceae, the Polymyanthe, I don't know these plant families. The Boraginaceae, that's more likely. I think forget-me-nots, but it could even be a variant of this one. The anemone patterns," I pointed out a full-colour illustration of a Pasque flower. "I don't think it was gentian of any kind. The petals weren't really rounded, but..." "Well, why not go back and get it?" he suggested. "Mr. Crook would lend you his old banger, perhaps, or..." "No, I've got a better idea. borrow Mrs. Bard's bicycle. It's safer. It's a short walk from the road to the foot of the hill. And then about 1,000 yards straight up, I said. Why are you so interested in that plant? I swiveled around to look at him. The parlour lamp outlined his head with a thin gold line, like a medieval engraving of a saint. It's not the plant I care about, but if you're going up there anyway, I wish you'd have a quick look around the outside of the stone circle. All right, I said obligingly. What for? Traces of fire, he said. In all the things I've been able to read about the Beltane, fire is always mentioned in the rituals, yet the women we saw this morning weren't using any. I wondered if perhaps they'd set the Beltane fire the night before, then come back in the morning for the dance. Though historically, it's the cowherds who were supposed to set the fire. There wasn't any trace of fire inside the circle, he added, but we left before I thought of checking the outside. All right, I said again and yawned. Two early risings in 2 days were taking their toll. I shut the book and stood up. Provided I don't have to get up before 9. It was in fact nearly 11 before I reached the stone circle. It was drizzling and I was soaked through. Again, not having thought to bring a Mac. I made a cursory examination of the outside of the circle, but if there had ever been a fire there, someone had taken pains to remove its traces. The plant was easier to find. It was where I remembered it, near the foot of the tallest stone. I took several clippings of the plant and stowed them temporarily in my handkerchief, meaning to deal with them properly when I got back to Mrs. Bard's bicycle, where I had left the plant press. The tallest stone of the circle was cleft, with a vertical split dividing the two massive pieces. Oddly, the pieces had been drawn apart by some means, though you could see that the facing surfaces matched. They were separated by a gap of 2 or 3 feet. There was a deep humming noise coming from somewhere near at hand. I thought there might be a beehive lodged in some crevice of the rock, and placed a hand on the stone in order to lean into the cleft. The stone screamed. I backed away as fast as I could, moving so quickly that I tripped on the short turf and sat down hard. I stared at the stone, sweating. I had never heard such a sound from anything living. There is no way to describe it, except to say that it was the sort of scream you might expect from a stone. It was horrible. The other stones began to shout. There was a noise of battle and the cries of dying men and shattered horses. I shook my head violently to clear it, but the noise went on. I stumbled to my feet and staggered towards the edge of the circle. The sounds were all around me, making my teeth ache and my head spin. My vision began to blur. I do not know whether I went deliberately towards the cleft in the main stone or whether it was accidental, a blind drifting through the fog of noise. Once, travelling at night, I fell asleep in the passenger seat of a moving car, lulled by the noise and motion into an illusion of serene weightlessness. The driver of the car took a bridge too fast and lost control, and I woke from my floating dream straight into the glare of headlights and the sickening sensation of falling at high speed. That abrupt transition is as close as I can come to describing the feeling I experienced, but it falls woefully short. I could say that my field of vision contracted to a single dark spot, then disappeared together, leaving not darkness but a bright void. I could say that I felt as though I were spinning, or as though I were being pulled inside out. All of these things are true, yet none of them conveys the sense I had of complete disruption, of being slammed very hard against something that wasn't there. The truth is that nothing moved, nothing changed, nothing whatever appeared to happen, and yet I experienced a feeling of elemental terror so great that I lost all sense of who or what or where I was. I was in the heart of chaos, and no power of mind or body was of use against it. I cannot really say I lost consciousness, but I was certainly not aware of myself for some time. I woke, if that's the word, when I stumbled on a rock near the bottom of the hill. I half slid the remaining few feet and fetched up on the thick tufted grass at the foot. I felt sick and dizzy. I crawled towards a stand of saplings and leaned against one to steady myself. There was a confused noise of shouting nearby, which reminded me of the sounds I had heard and felt in the circle. The ring of inhuman violence was lacking, though. This was the normal sound of human conflict, and I turned towards it. And that is the end of chapter 2. Chapter 3, The Man in the Wood, we will get to next week. It definitely feels like we have kicked off into the adventure, because the end of that chapter felt like a threshold scene. So I think we're away. Exciting to see what happens in the next chapter. I hope you enjoyed listening and reading along and enjoyed the show. Be good. Stay kinky, as if you had any choice in the matter. See you next time.
To support this space and to get access to TFD's exclusive guides to kink, spicy content and more, check out his Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefunnydom. You're listening to the Funny Dom podcast.